This is the time of year when many of us make New Year's resolutions to lose weight, eat healthier, maybe join a gym. But for seniors who may already be dealing with the complications of aging, is it realistic to expect one can change a lifetime of bad habits to become healthier?
I'd like to believe that it is at any point in our lives. Now, clearly, we don't get to the point. And by the way, as you know, I'm 82 years old, so I've got a little bit of experience with resolutions kept and unkept and so on. But I don't believe it's impossible at any point during the period of our lives to make resolutions, some of which we'll cling to and some of which we won't. But I think it's always within our control to do something about things that we're not crazy about, whether it's weight gain or a poor diet or whatever.
Well, weight gain seems to be a part of aging. And so is it even possible to lose weight and keep it off during our senior years?
Well, I would dispute that. I don't believe that weight gain is inherently a part of aging. What is inherently a part of aging is that our weight tends to shift around. We men, of course, tend to have the fat accumulate in our bellies. Women, it's distributed somewhat differently. But I don't believe there's anything inherent in aging that says that we gain weight. I would like to believe that it's far more important that we somehow lose our control of it. And whether it's creeping on at 1 pound a year, which in 40 years is 40 pounds of weight gain, or whether it's coming on very quickly. But I really do not believe that there is something inherent in aging which leads to weight gain. I think it can be controlled at any stage in our lives.
There's so much information out there about nutrition, about dietary supplements and medications, and some of this information contradictory. So how do you make sense of it all?
That can be very difficult. And the thing that I'd like to mention is the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994. This came about largely through the efforts of then the senior senator from Utah, Orrin Hatch. And Utah is the center of the supplement industry in this country. The Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994 essentially defines a dietary supplement as an amino acid, a mineral, a vitamin, a botanical product. And having defined it that way, it then sets down that the Food and Drug Administration, which, as you know, has oversight over our prescription drugs, has virtually no power to control dietary supplements. So, and the estimate that something like $30 to possibly $40 billion a year is spent on such supplements, I would venture to say that 99% of that is wasted money. The claims that are made for these supplements are simply not defensible on scientific grounds.
So when we take fish oil or vitamins, minerals, you're saying perhaps they're not useful?
Not only perhaps, but in most cases. Now, there are exceptions. A pregnant woman very often, quite justifiably, will take a folic acid supplement, which will decrease the probability of birth defects of a certain kind. There may be determined by laboratory measurements that anemia is present, in which case an iron supplement is given. There may be a situation where you have a housebound elderly person, particularly of dark complexion, who gets virtually no sunlight. There you may want to have a vitamin D supplement. But as with everything else in trying to decide what's good and bad for us, the situation is constantly changing as new studies come about and so forth. But you mentioned fish oil. For a while, it looked real good, and then more studies came along and said, well, it's probably not really doing anything for anyone. But each one of these is a separate issue, and in almost all cases, we cannot justify the use of supplements. And if you're bound and determined, and remember, something like two-thirds of the American people take a dietary supplement, so clearly there is great belief in their efficacy. But if you are bound and determined, fine, take a multivitamin. When you walk down that endless aisle with the individual vitamins in their containers, I would avoid them completely. Now, personally, I took a multivitamin for many years. And then on principle, I said, I'm not going to do this anymore because I am confident by paying attention to what we eat and how we eat that we can get all of the vitamins and minerals that we need in a good diet. And I've mentioned there are exceptions to this where you may want to have supplements, but by and large, it's a waste of money.
Let's talk about medications. Most of us rely on what our doctors recommend for us. Yet there are seniors who take 6-7 different drugs a day. As a professor who studied this, are all these medications necessary?
Well, each one of those represents a separate question. Now, particularly in the elderly, particularly with as multiple health concerns come along, and particularly if a person is being treated by multiple physicians, if there is not a regular assessment of the drugs that are being prescribed, there is a real possibility, one, that some of the drugs may not be doing anymore what we want them to do, but perhaps more important, there is the possibility of drug interactions. Every time you add a drug to the regimen, you increase the probability that there might be drug interactions. Now, how do we get at this? It can be very difficult because most of us do not often see our primary care physician if we have a primary care physician. And very often, patients are reluctant to challenge their physicians on the drugs that are being used and so forth. So you have to be a little bit careful with that. My feeling is, particularly for the elderly, including myself, that we need an advocate. We need somebody, perhaps a family member, to look at the drugs and to, you can Google everything these days and you can find interactions. And if you do go online and you want to go to the Mayo Clinic health letter, you know that you're getting very valuable information. And certainly that will talk about drug interactions. But it certainly can be a problem with them. And I would mention a particular class of drugs, the so-called benzodiazepines. These are anti-anxiety agents, such as Librium and Valium, which are the trade names for diazepam and chlordiazepoxide, Halcyon, Alprazolam, and so forth. These are very often used in the elderly for control of anxiety. And for reasons which I do not particularly understand, they can be particularly troublesome in the elderly, leading to paradoxical reactions where instead of decreasing anxiety, they may increase anxiety. The other thing that happens with these drugs, and they came on the market and displaced the barbiturates, which were killing people in overdose. They don't kill you in overdose, but you do become physically dependent, which means that if you try abruptly to stop taking the drug, you will have a withdrawal reaction. And in this case, profound increase in the anxiety, which the drug was originally intended to control. And so once you're on these drugs, it can be very difficult to get off of them. But anyway, particular problem in the elderly.
Dr. Winter, is the one thing not in dispute for seniors is the need to remain active, to do some sort of exercise?
I believe that is absolutely true. I'm a firm believer in exercise of all kinds, and what particularly seniors should recognize is that you don't have to be a triathlete or a extreme exerciser or whatever. That anything that keeps you moving, anything that gets you off the couch. Long ago, somebody said that some of us, we reach a certain age and we settle into our rocker and read the Bible. And we may have a very long time ahead of us because we may have another 20 or 30 years ahead of us. What you want to do is to try to, if you don't already have activities that keep you moving, whether it be dance or formal exercise, aerobic, anaerobic, and so forth, you want to seek them out and you want to keep active as long as you can. And you have to, there will be adjustments that will be made. And if I can take a minute, I'll give you a personal example of that. As I said, I'm now in my 80s and I have been running and doing weight training my whole life. Probably 10 years ago, I developed sciatica. And after going through today's routine of anesthesiologists who want to inject things into my spine and neurosurgeons who want to do surgery and so forth, nature began to come into play, and I gradually got better. But then I, as part of that, I saw a physical therapist who told me that my running was probably what was aggravating the sciatica. So I had to make an adjustment. And today, I no longer run. Instead, I purchased not a Peloton, but an inexpensive exercise cycle, and I do all my aerobic exercise now on that cycle, and you can get a very good workout that way. And I'm knocking on wood, perhaps the sciatica will not return. So you have to be ready to adjust to the infirmities that come with old age, but you keep going. You keep finding new things to do to keep yourself moving.
As you mentioned, you're 82, you're still teaching, you're writing books. Do you see yourself somewhat of a role model for those hoping to successfully navigate the aging process?
I would be reluctant to take on that role for one reason.
Okay.
We are always at the mercy of, if you want, we're at the mercy of God, we're at the mercy of luck, we're at the mercy of chance. I've been fortunate in my life not to have major physical problems so that I can keep going. But we always have to be aware. I could have awakened this morning with a glioblastoma or pancreatic cancer or any of the other things, which so terribly, and I didn't mention Alzheimer's disease, any of those things can hit us, and we literally at this point have no control over whether they're going to happen or not. You can exercise till the cows come home. You can eat absolutely the best diet, and you still can get hit with one of those things. So as far as being a role model for anything, I'm a role model for being lucky.
Okay.
And I hope that everybody is equally lucky.
Now, you have a new book coming out, and is it about some of the things we're talking about here?
It's a little bit different.
Okay.
My first two books, the one which I did quite a long time ago, and then the second, which came out 4 years ago, we're on nutrition, exercise, and so forth. The book that just came out this past December is on psychoactive drugs, those drugs that act on our brains to change the way the world looks to us. And I try to cover the whole range. There's a chapter on opioids, which we hear so much about nowadays. There's a chapter on marijuana, again, which we hear so much about with medical and recreational marijuana becoming more and more common. There's a chapter on stimulant drugs such as methamphetamine, amphetamines, Ritalin, and so forth. There's a chapter on depressant drugs, and of course, the big depressant drug is alcohol and the disease of alcoholism and so forth. Then a little bit more esoterically, there's something on ketamine, which has been a drug of abuse, regarded as a drug of abuse, and now has been approved for the treatment of depression. There's a chapter on what is popularly known as ecstasy, methylene dioxymethamphetamine, or MDMA, which is very close to getting FDA approval for the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder, which, as you know, has become a much more recognized problem with the Iraq War veterans and so forth. And it's really a wonderful story of one man. Rick Doblin has spent literally 30 years bringing ecstasy from being just a party drug, a rave drug, into possibly being used very effectively for treating something like PTSD. Hmm. And then I finish it up, well, my favorite, because most of my research in my past years had to do with hallucinogenic agents. I talk about LSD and mescaline and DMT and psilocybin. And psilocybin, by the way, is very much, this is the ingredient in so-called magic mushrooms. Psilocybin is now being promoted, and I think that evidence is getting very good that it may be useful also in conjunction with psychotherapy for a number of mental disorders. And then I finish it up with a chapter that is a little bit different. It has to do with the war on drugs, and I introduce the term of pharmacological puritanism, where we have to somehow come to terms with the fact that an enormous number of people find some pleasure in a variety of these drugs, which we generally call drugs of abuse, and somehow we've got to figure out how to match up our opposition to the bad things they do with the the fact that many people find them attractive. And I suppose marijuana would be a good example there. Mm-hmm. There are those who believe it's a very dangerous drug, and there are those who believe it's a very beneficial drug. And somehow, as a society, we've got to figure out how to approach these problems. And mentioned the opioid problem. We've got to approach these problems with rational treatment rather than incarceration, which has been an abject failure.
What's the title of the book is?
The title of the book is Our Love Affair with Drugs, the History, the Science, the Politics.
And it's available at Amazon and bookstores?
With Amazon and various other places, yes. Oxford University Press did the publication.
Dr. Winter, I thank you so much for joining us.
You're very quite welcome. As you could hear as I talked, I love these subjects and I love to talk about them, and I hope I didn't go on too long for you.